let the show go on. Peter B. Collins! Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Friday, July 28th, 2017. And those of us who oppose the repeal and destruction of Obamacare, even though Obamacare needs a lot of work, well, we can heave a unified sigh of relief because they tried to kill it in the middle of the night. And the Republicans came up one vote short. And John McCain, playing the maverick once again, that's a role that he slips in and out of. He is a hero to some at this moment. He did cast the deciding vote that clobbered Mitch McConnell's scheme to try to repeal Obamacare without any real replacement. And this has left the Republican Party sharply divided, unable to deliver on their signature campaign issue. And the divisions in the party will not heal very quickly, even as they try to move on from health care to other issues. And the permanent damage, well, remains to be seen how permanent it is. Maybe that word is too strong. But the lingering damage, I believe, will be a factor in the 2018 Senate elections. People like Rob Portman in Ohio, Capito in West Virginia, Dean Heller is up for re-election in Nevada next year. Lindsey Graham soiled himself by trying to take a principled stand, saying that this repeal was half-assed and that the policy was, just ridiculous. He's got egg on his face because he ended up voting for this piece of crap. And also Ron Johnson from Wisconsin, who tried to, grandstand and play many different sides of this debate. He voted for it and perhaps will pay a price at the polls down the road. But a lot of focus is on John McCain, so I'm going to hold on to some of the commentary about the senator from Arizona, because coming up in less than 25 minutes, Cliff Schechter is going to join us. He wrote this book called The Real McCain and published it back in 2007 or 2008. And he knows a lot about the former Vietnam War prisoner who served in the House and later in the Senate from Arizona. And we're going to talk about that, honestly, because there are a lot of efforts to redefine who he is because of his brain cancer diagnosis and because of this moment in the early hours of this day in the Senate. So the skinny repeal was defeated 49-51, and, skinny repeal again was just another tag for withdrawing health care coverage from, in this case, 16 million Americans in order to fund tax cuts for the people who pay for Republican campaigns, the uber wealthy and the corporate interests. And the Republicans could not pull their caucus together in a way to get to the even narrow margin of the 51 votes with Mike Pence, the vice president, casting a breaker, as he did the other day, to reopen debate. That was on Tuesday. And so there is a sigh of relief that this failed. But what remains of Obamacare is subject to further distress. And the Republicans have intentionally talked it down. They've scared the insurance marketplace and the corporate minders of that marketplace. And these are the people who are going to have to set the rates for Obamacare in 2018 in the next 2 to 3 weeks. And we will find out just how much damage has been done to the markets, and it will be reflected in insurers who pull out of certain states or communities and in the rates that we pay for what in some cases may be diminished coverage. So while we have gotten past this specific battle and Planned Parenthood has not been cut by this legislation, but expect that to come back. It's a favorite punching bag of the Republican right. And so many of these, at least the threads of this struggle, will remain alive. And The Democrats, to their credit, did remain unified. Not a single Democrat, bolted from the caucus to support the bad moves of the Republicans time after time this week. And Chuck Schumer deserves some credit. I think that I'll modify my position on him. He has shown that he is more than just a grandstanding media hog, and that he does have some pretty smart ways of countering the Republican majority, and that he is able to hold together a caucus that includes a few liberals anymore. It's a lot of centrists. And then the conservative Democrats like Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Bill Nelson of Florida is one of my favorite conservadems. When I say favorite, that's ironic, okay? Anyway, this has left Republicans in both the House and the Senate on record, placing votes, taking votes that will come back to haunt them. Because they failed. They didn't kill the beast. And so the hardline voters who wanted Obamacare dead will be disappointed. And they didn't do anything to improve the lot of millions of Americans, even some Trump voters, who thought they wanted Obamacare repealed or at least modified in some way. And we have to be fair when we talk about the Democrats going forward. Some of them are saying, well, let's take a look at lowering prescription drug prices through negotiation. I'm all in favor. But Democrats cannot unify around single payer, and they won't unify around various approaches to tinkering with Obamacare. So, as McCain said when he flew on that private jet back to Washington Tuesday, to cast a deciding vote to reopen debate on this whole process, and we'll talk with Cliff Schechter about that in a few minutes, he did block. And he pissed off the president. He certainly has disappointed Mitch McConnell. And, of course, he says, my days are numbered here. He does live with the knowledge that he has a limited life expectancy now. And maybe this was the real McCain, but I hesitate to reach for that. Donald Trump would probably like to withdraw this tweet that he made on Tuesday morning. So great that John McCain is coming back to vote. Brave. American hero. Thank you, John. Now, McCain's not stupid. He knows that that does not withdraw the insult that Trump visited on him during the campaign last year, when he said he liked heroes who didn't get captured. So I've got some stuff about McCain. We'll talk with Cliff Schechter about that coming up at the half hour. That's at 5:30 Eastern, 2:30 Pacific. And we're going to welcome your phone calls, too. If you want to jot down the number, here it is. You can call in on 415-455-0102. Do you like my high-tech Chiron? 415-455-0102. A lot of people have noticed that in the Italian language and in describing the Italian theatrical form known as commedia dell'arte, which is, I think, roughly similar to vaudeville in the United States, the term scaramouche, in Italian, scaramuccia, is a stock character of the Italian theatrical form known as commedia dell'arte, an unscrupulous and unreliable servant. His affinity for intrigue often landed him in difficult situations, yet he always managed to extricate himself, usually leaving an innocent bystander as his victim. Now, the namesake is Anthony Scaramucci, who is now into his first week as a White House communications director. And boy, has he fouled the air. I'm sure you're aware of his salty language, his insults to Reince Priebus and Steve Bannon, the White House senior advisors who tried to block his appointment a week ago when Trump overruled them. And it appears that Trump egged him on. They were having dinner with Sean Hannity and this idiot, Kimberly Guilfoyle, who's a Fox News anchor and who was once a San Franciscan. And what we are seeing is that Scaramucci had dinner and Trump apparently put him up to it. And I'm just seeing on Facebook right now that Reince Priebus has been fired. Trump says that he has named Homeland Security Chief Secretary John Kelly as the White House Chief of Staff. Now, I have to say, I expected high turnover in the Trump White House, but I didn't expect it to be this fast. So what we can see is that Scaramucci now has one scalp that he can take credit for, and that's Reince Priebus. And Priebus, of course, was Trump's bridge to the party establishment. He had run the DNC. And in recent days, Trump was taking turns hammering Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, and his White House chief of staff. And one of the beefs, Trump has a long memory. If you cross him just once, he will never forget. So Priebus last October suggested that Trump drop out of the presidential race after the pussy grabbing tape was released. And as recently as this week, Trump asked other associates, "Do you remember when Reince did that?" So it's very interesting because Trump now uses this public hazing of Sessions, of Priebus. And not only does it humiliate the individuals, but it also sends a message to other people, pardon me, not to step out of line. And Jeff Sessions, who is on a photo op tour of El Salvador trying to show how tough he is on the MS-13 street gang, and Trump held a news conference in New York today with the same theme. Well, Jeffrey Beauregard, beleaguered Jim Crow Sessions III, told the Associated Press, "It hasn't been my best week in his relationship with the president. It's kind of hurtful, but the president of the United States is a strong leader." And my friend Roger Shuler, who has covered the corruption in Alabama for years now at the Legal Schnauzer blog, he wrote a piece the other day saying, "Don't feel sorry for Jeff Sessions because he's just as much a snake as Donald Trump is." You can find that article at the Legal Schnauzer site. And if you're so inclined, help them out with a contribution. The Shulers are living week to week and could use some extra cash. There's a PayPal button at the Legal Schnauzer page. So this is quite a scene where Scaramucci is operating like a mob enforcer. And he is trying to plug the leaks at the White House, but I don't think all the leaks are coming from the White House. somebody should start a pool on how long Anthony Scaramucci will be on the staff at the White House. Meanwhile, yesterday, before they got down to the grueling all-nighter session, it wasn't quite all night, but the late-night session to try to repeal Obamacare, the Senate passed the new sanctions that are aimed at Russia, Iran, and North Korea. And I have news on all three. So, as you know, I don't support these sanctions. They're being based on evidence that we haven't seen and claims that haven't been proven, that Russia hacked the DNC, that Russia manipulated our election, and that Putin personally directed all this. So with the advent of these new sanctions, Russia is finally retaliating, and they have announced the closure of two properties in Moscow that are being seized. One was someplace where the embassy staff like to walk their dogs and have barbecues. The other was just another building that the U.S. has possession of. And he also has ordered the staff at the U.S. embassy in Moscow to be reduced to the same number of Russian embassy personnel in the United States. Now, this kind of tit-for-tat sanction stuff is very counterproductive, in my opinion, and it really is done for domestic political consumption. And so I don't see this as being very meaningful. Here are the details. Starting August 1st, next Tuesday, Russia will block access to a warehouse in Moscow and to a site along the Moscow River where staff members walk their dogs and hold barbecues. That'll show them, right? That'll change everything. And Putin told a reporter that the U.S. sanctions are illegal and that Moscow cannot put up forever with this boorishness. And, well, you can take that for what it is. Meanwhile, the new sanctions on Iran are coupled with open threats from Donald Trump to find an excuse to create a reckless provocation for the U.S. to announce that it is going to try to withdraw from the Iranian nuclear deal. Now, on one hand, because it was not a treaty ratified by the Senate, Trump does have some latitude to withdraw the United States, but it doesn't end the agreement because Britain, China, France, Germany, and Russia were the other parties with Iran in this deal. And just like the climate accords from Paris, the U.S. withdrawal does not end them or their participation by other countries. And it's clear that Trump and his militant advisors are looking for a way to confront Iran militarily. This is extremely dangerous. It's really the policies of the state of Israel because Iran does not pose a direct threat to the United States. And I fear wider U.S. military operations in the Middle East. Then there's North Korea. Today they launched another missile. It may be an intercontinental ballistic missile, an ICBM. It dropped in the water off Hokkaido, the northernmost island of the nation of Japan, and it was in the air for about 45 minutes. Now, I counsel calm and caution because the new sanctions on North Korea will not affect Kim Jong-un in any way, shape, or form. He's still going to be able to get his scotch and his porn, and he doesn't care about the impact of sanctions on the average citizen of North Korea. And I believe that taking a bully on with bully tactics will only encourage more bully-like behavior. Every day I like to stop for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Linda Gray, Steve Wozenski, Judy Holloway, and the gentleman from the Netherlands who recently requested anonymity. I'm grateful to each and every one of you. And wherever you're watching, if you're checking us out on Facebook today, or if you listen to the podcast on a regular basis, I would like to get your support. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu button. When it pulls down, you click on Become a Subscriber. That takes you to the sign-up page, giving you options of $5, $10, $20 a month. Our $50 annual subscription can earn you a bonus book. And don't forget the PBC app. It's available for under $3 at the Apple App Store. And it works on iPhones and iPads, and I use it on a regular basis. It's very handy. I want to thank listener Debbie Inco, who lives in Colorado, and sent me an article from the Colorado Springs Independent newspaper, because this is the first I've learned of whistleblowers who are being retaliated against for doing their job responding to sexual assault reports at the U.S. Air Force Academy. Now, separately, over the last few years, the Air Force Academy has been exposed as a hotbed of Christian activism at the expense of non-believers and people of other faiths. And Mikey Weinstein, who started the Military Religious Freedom Foundation, has exposed what goes on at the Air Force Academy. Now, those same devout Christianists cover up sexual assault by cadets on other cadets. And this has been going on for years. So in 2007, Teresa Beasley and others joined the Air Force Academy in response to the reports of increased sexual assaults. Well, most recently, she has been placed on leave and booted from her office at the Air Force Academy because she's been speaking up about tactics that the Academy used against victims and ways that they massaged statistics to try to cover up increases in sexual assault reports. So about three years ago, Beasley said she and a victim's advocate were told by a cadet that a provider at the Academy's center, a counseling office, had sexually harassed her. The cadet filed a complaint with the Pentagon Inspector General because she didn't trust the internal process at the Academy. Then Beasley and her colleague gave statements on the cadet's behalf, and that's when they started to face retaliation. And there's this new rule that allows the Academy to exclude dozens of cases in its statistical reporting by claiming that the cadet didn't fill out the right paperwork in order to qualify for listing in the statistical database. Over at Shadowproof, the great reporter Kevin Gostola is taking a look at the trial up in Spokane, Washington, a civil case against the two CIA contractors, the consultants Jessen and Mitchell, whose firm was paid $81 million to devise and supervise the torture program. And as we discussed with John Kiriakou and Joe Hickman in our in-depth interview a couple of weeks ago, these torture consultants are using a Nazi Nuremberg defense. And it's actually been expanded because just today, lawyers for Mitchell and Jessen invoked the case of Carl Raschke, or Rashi, a banker who had facilitated large loans to a fund at the disposal of Heinrich Himmler, the despised head of the Schutzstaffel, the SS, and also Joachim Drosin, who was a gassing technician for the firm that manufactured the poison gas Zyklon B, used to exterminate Jewish people in concentration camps, and nobody told Sean Spicer about that. Anyway, they are now using the case of the individuals involved with Zyklon B and claiming that the guy who actually delivered the gas was not guilty because he had been following orders. Now, John Kiriakou, quoted by Gostola here, says that this cements their place in history, not just in history but in infamy. When they have to rely on the defenses of accused Nazi war criminals to defend themselves, they can't go any lower. And Kiriakou later said that Mitchell and Jessen should have known that torture was illegal and their training would be used to carry out an illegal program. They were instrumental in the creation and implementation of that program. They were the ones arguing for it with CIA's leadership. They were not innocent bystanders. Well, I'm glad to see John Kiriakou stepping forward and offering such strong statements, because the silence of all the people who are complicit in the torture program, from Don Rumsfeld and David Addington and Dick Cheney and the White House to others, they're getting a pass. They're not on trial with Mitchell and Jessen, and they should be. And that silence is a big moral outrage to me, and I think to the reputation of the United States. Also, speaking of the CIA, Gareth Porter has another great story, this one published at the American Conservative, breaking down the timeline of U.S. covert support for the so-called moderate Syrian rebels in Syria. And this, of course, has been a bone of contention between me and Obama and his advisors. And I supported President Obama when he declined to put lots of U.S. troops into Syria back in 2011 and 2012, as he was being urged to do by first Hillary Clinton and then John Kerry at the State Department and by CIA leaders. And as Gareth Porter reports, not one of Obama's advisors had sufficient understanding of regional dynamics to warn Obama that Iran would not allow their Syrian ally to be overthrown by an opposition supported by Sunni states and the U.S. And he explains how Obama said no to heavy weapons, a no-fly zone, or an official U.S. role in supplying arms, but he did agree to a covert CIA operation designed by David Petraeus to load weapons from the Libyan government stocks in Benghazi on ships and arrange for them to be shipped to the war zone. And this is what was covered up about Benghazi. That's why Hillary Clinton was on the defensive and Susan Rice had to stick to the CIA talking points, and it created the whole basis. And Trey Gowdy, who led the Benghazi Inquisition, knew exactly all of this stuff, but never permitted that to be entered into the record. And Hillary was over a covert barrel, where she could not acknowledge what the real role of the Benghazi facilities were. And so I encourage you to read Gareth Porter's piece. I think it offers a lot of insight into how we got into that mess in Syria. Meanwhile, you remember it was at the beginning of this year the Panama Papers surfaced. And it was interesting dirt on the finances of many wealthy individuals on a global basis. We're told that there was exposure of funds that are linked to Vladimir Putin, for example. Well, we now have the first victim of the release of the Panama Papers. Nawaz Sharif, the Prime Minister of Pakistan, has been ordered out of office. He's been booted by the Supreme Court of Pakistan today. They ordered his removal over accusations of corruption. Now, he's in his third term in office. He claims he never did anything wrong. But his kids own expensive properties around the world, and there were other indications of corruption and corrupt acquisition of wealth by Sharif during this term in office. Now, I want to say that the Bhutto family has kind of alternated with Sharif during, three terms now? And we've had, what was his name? Pervez Musharraf, the general who took power in a coup and was bought and paid for by the U.S. during the Bush administration. There's been no end to corruption in high places in Pakistan. And so what is really news here is that this time the judiciary has taken strong action and the military has yet to intervene. Now, Pakistan has cracked down on criticism of the government online. There is a new law that was passed earlier this year, and dozens of people have been arrested and investigated since January for their social media use under the sweeping cybercrimes law that was passed late last year. It's called the Prevention of Electronic Crimes Act, and they claim that they do not monitor the ISI, Inter Services Intelligence, the notorious equivalent of the CIA in Pakistan. They say, no, when people complain, that's when we investigate. You believe that? At the Dark Hat Conference in Las Vegas this week, a guy named Nitay Artenstein, who is a cybersecurity expert, exposed a bug, a patched bug found in the chips used to provide Wi-Fi in iPhones, Samsung Galaxies, and the Google Nexus device. These bugs could be used to build malware, which jumps unstoppably from one device to the next. Now, this sounds pretty scary. They are encouraging people to get updates. If you got an iPhone, you want to be on 10.3.3. The July security update for Android contains a fix for this flaw. And that's about all I know about that. We're now learning that the Wells Fargo wagon that fleeced millions of its customers by having commission-incentivized workers falsely open credit card accounts and savings accounts and other accounts, well, this stuff has not stopped being exposed. The latest is that 800,000 people who took out car loans from Wells Fargo were charged for auto insurance that they didn't need. Some of them are still paying for it, and in some cases, it led to overdrafts and defaults on the car loans, leading to as many as 25,000 wrongful vehicle repossessions. Now, it was one thing when you say, well, you know, they took advantage of an old lady and opened up an account she didn't need. But this is grand theft. This is what they call a RICO scheme. It's racketeering. I don't think that Wells Fargo has paid enough of a price for this so far. And finally today, I've learned that Lorene Powell Jobs, who inherited almost $11 billion when Steve Jobs died in 2011, she is in line now to take control of the Atlantic magazine. The guy who's owned it for the last 10 years or so, whose name is David Bradley, announced that he will sell the anchor of his media empire, the 160-year-old magazine, to Lorene Powell Jobs, Steve Jobs' widow, and one of the richest people in the world. So we have a trend now that media outlets are being bought by wealthy individuals. Jeff Bezos, whose Amazon shares briefly made him the richest man in the world for a while yesterday when the market was up. He bought the Washington Post. And we now have billionaire Jobs buying the Atlantic, and at some point, perhaps many of our major media outlets will simply be house organs for the wealthiest among us. Well, it's 2:31 Pacific time here, and I want to open up the phone lines here, because any second now, Cliff Schechter is going to be joining me. He is the author of The Real McCain, and he published this book, as I mentioned, back in 2007-2008, as McCain was gearing up to run for president. And when you look at the career of John McCain, there have been just a few moments that feed the sense of heroism, celebrity, and is maverickism a word? I don't think it is quite. At any rate, I have never had the highest opinion of John McCain. I first became aware of him as part of the Keating Five scandal. And I took special interest in the Keating scandal because Charlie Keating, at the center of it all, the savings and loan fraudster, he had been a classmate of my father's at St. Xavier High School in Cincinnati. They graduated together in 1941. And so I had more than a passing interest in the Keating scandal. And it affected five members of the U.S. Senate, including Alan Cranston, who at the time was the senior senator here in California, and who did leave the Senate in disgrace because of his connections to Charlie Keating and the savings and loan operation that was based in Arizona. Keating gave millions of dollars to Alan Cranston's voter registration drives that were led by his son, Kim. And it wasn't a totally clean deal. And then when Charlie Keating got in trouble with federal regulators, he called his friends, Alan Cranston and John McCain. I think Dennis DeConcini was one. And I'm struggling to remember the rest of the Gang of Five who comprised the Keating Five. At any rate, this was an ugly episode, and for whatever reason, John McCain kind of skated. And in the book, The Real McCain, Cliff Schechter exposed the business dealings of Cindy McCain, who owns the Budweiser franchise for the Phoenix and perhaps all of Arizona, and used that to increase her wealth and her influence in that state. It's interesting to see that Paul Krugman today, not knowing that John McCain would cast the deciding vote after midnight and well after the Times went to bed, so to speak, he did not go lightly on McCain in his column published Friday. He said, you know, Republicans don't have any good policies to offer on health care, so a bum's rush is the only way they can pass anything. And McCain, who has demanded a return to regular order in the Senate, turns out to be perfectly willing to help the bums get rushed. None of what is happening right now would be possible without the acquiescence of politicians who pretend to be open-minded, decry partisanship, tut-tut about incivility, and act as enablers for the extremists again and again. Krugman continues, I started with McCain because so many journalists still fall for his pose as an independent-minded maverick, ignoring the reality that he's a reliable partisan yes-man whenever it matters. Incredibly, some commentators actually praised his performance this week, focusing on his noble-sounding words and ignoring his utterly craven actions. But he has rivals in the hypocrisy sweepstakes. And there we have the mention that Rob Portman, Shelley Moore Capito, and Dean Heller occupy the same space as John McCain in that respect. Well, I'm not hearing from Cliff Schechter right now. I do expect him to call in here shortly. If you would like to call in and talk about John McCain or talk about any other issues in the news that are on your mind today, go ahead and call me right now. It's 415-455-0102. That's 415-455-0102. And while I'm waiting for your calls and for Cliff Schechter's call, I wanted to share with you an excerpt from my in-depth interview earlier this week with a very interesting man, Dan Kovalik. He is a human rights and labor lawyer based in Pittsburgh. He's currently in Caracas, Venezuela, observing the election there that's taking place on Sunday. And he wrote this new book called The Plot to Scapegoat Russia. And in it, he warns that many progressives, in embracing the Trump-Russia narrative, are leading us to the brink of war with Russia. Let's listen to this comment from Dan Kovalik.
Especially when it comes to this issue. I mean, and that is the irony, that the one issue the Democrats have seized upon, this Russia issue vis-a-vis Trump, is the one issue that, frankly, of all of Trump's policies, actually makes some sense, right? So what the Democrats have done, either wittingly or unwittingly, is painted Trump into a corner whereby he will have no choice but to act in aggressive ways towards Russia in order to prove that he's not a puppet of Putin. And so, in fact, the Democrats, by their conduct, are pushing Trump closer and closer to war. And so that is what is most troubling, that the issue that they've seized upon is quite destructive. And in fact, some Democrats have gone so far as to say that we should bomb Russia because of this alleged hacking. Mm-hmm. And that's, of course, the height of insanity. Who would say such a thing, given that we're both nuclear powers? But that's how far this lie, let me say, has gone, that now to back it up, people are saying we should actually go to war, and that it's the Democrats and even rank-and-file liberals who are supporting this is a bit mind-boggling.
That's Dan Kovalik. As I mentioned, his new book is called The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, and I had a great conversation with him. The full interview is available at peterbcollins.com. Let's see who's on the phone line here this afternoon. Good afternoon. This is the Peter B. Collins podcast.
Peter B.
Hi, who's this?
This is Paul Elsesser.
Hi, Paul. Nice to hear from you today. How's it going?
Good. I've been meaning to call you for a while. I listen to your podcast almost every day when I'm walking my dog, but I always seem to forget in the afternoon to call you on Fridays, you know?
Uh-huh.
So I finally remembered and caught up with you.
Well, great. And you've called on a day when it appears my Facebook feed didn't work.
Actually, it was working. I was watching you. I watched the first half hour of it, and then when I heard you open the phone lines, why, I dialed your number, And you couldn't have timed it any better, because I actually wanted to comment on your podcast with Dan Kovalik.
Well, great. And thanks for confirming. First of all, thanks for confirming the video worked, because what I'm seeing online is that some people couldn't get connected to it and they didn't get a notification. So something went sideways at Facebook, and I apologize for that. But please go ahead and talk about Kovalik.
Well, first, I wanted to thank you for everything you do for us.
Well, I just call it the way I see it. And if I didn't do this, I'd be locked up in an asylum somewhere, Paul.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. But still, you enlighten all of us and help us and keep our sanity too. Anyway, back to Kovalik. His book and what he's talking about in there, the whole Russian narrative. I mean, isn't that just a classic red herring? I mean, trying to distract us away from all the stuff that's really going on in the world.
Well, and as he pointed out in the clip that I just played, the really pernicious part of this is the Democratic partisans are really stoking the tensions with Russia, and some are even calling for war over this whole unproven scenario of hacking and manipulation. And one of the things that I talked to Kovalik and I've talked to others about is that, like David Cobb of the Green Party, who we recently did an interview with, is that, there are plenty of domestic suspects. And just yesterday, I was pointing out the media blackout of this investigation of Imran, I don't have his name in front of me, but this is the IT advisor to Debbie Wasserman Schultz. His whole family was on the federal payroll. They have left the country while they're under investigation for some fraud charges. And I'm not offering that I have information that could indict them, but shouldn't we examine them as suspects for the DNC leak before we, start risking international relations and risking ultimately a nuclear exchange?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and as Kovalik points out, though, I mean, anything that's contrary to the official narrative, gets pushed under the rug, or people never hear it. I mean, that's why we support people like me, support and listen to you, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, I do appreciate that. Last night, I heard Rachel Maddow, for only the second time, acknowledge that there is another side to this. And she served it up so that she could dismiss and ridicule the people who raise questions about alternative theories about how the information got from the DNC to WikiLeaks. And there are many routes that would not include Russian hackers or any connection to the Russian government. And Paul, as you've heard since you listen almost every day, I freely leave open the possibility that I could be wrong and that facts may be revealed down the road that will substantiate these claims. And maybe some of these leakers will come out of the woodwork and tie their names to the charges that have been floated. But so far, we have nothing substantial to work with. And the arc of this narrative has gone so far, you may have heard me invoke the cantilever law.
Yeah, right, with your deck.
A while back. Well, I've been spending a lot of time this week sanding and staining those decks. And let me just repeat the notion here that for a deck to stick out without any supports, you know, piers or vertical support, it has to have horizontal attachment to the building that is twice as long as the unsupported extension. And I believe that we've gone well beyond the law of cantilever, and this whole Rachel Maddow narrative could collapse under its own weight. And, of course, she would just move on and talk about something else and never really acknowledge it. But note that no critics, including Glenn Greenwald, Robert Perry, or even yours truly, have been invited to come on MSNBC and say, hey, let's talk this over. You know, let's try to separate fact from fantasy and fact from speculation. They're not interested in that. They are promoting a kind of soft porn telenovela, a soap opera.
It's the official narrative, and that's what they get paid to present.
Right.
And it's the official narrative. That's all there is to it, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I appreciate your, are remaining skeptical and willing to listen to some of the voices that I bring into the podcast because, this is the work that I do. I'm an independent. You know, I'm not an apologist for the Democrats, and I'm clearly not an apologist for Trump. And my goal is to follow the facts. And so far, we've seen a lot of speculation, a lot of multiple reports without multiple sources that are treated as verification of information that still remains evidence-free.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, the last thing I'd like to say is I'd like to encourage everybody that listens to this or has listened to you to listen to Kovalik and your interview of him if they haven't, and to buy his book. We need to support truth tellers like him. The guy is very articulate. I was impressed.
All right. Well, Paul, thanks for checking in today. And let me identify you as my most consistent deep pocket supporter. And I really appreciate those checks that arrive like clockwork on the first of every month.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay, Paul. Really appreciate it. That's Paul Elsesser. He lives north of Sacramento here in California. And he's been on board as a supporter of the Peter B. Collins podcast almost since day one. Well, I don't know what happened to the Facebook feed today. Paul was able to see it, but Carl Howard in Columbus can't find it anywhere. And also, we didn't connect with Cliff Schechter as I had hoped. But you just saw experienced a live recording of the Peter B. Collins podcast. And that's how it works when we do it live. Thanks for listening. And as always, I appreciate your comments. You can email Peter, peterbcollins.com.
To you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.